We're going to finish today talking a bit about fault tolerance. We started talking about this a little bit last time, and I'll just say a few words about you know, what you can actually say in general about making quantum computation fault tolerant when you're trying to compute in the presence of noise. And then the main thing we're going to talk about today is quantum key distribution, which is just a different topic about how you can get some cryptographic security out of quantum mechanics. And this, you know, we'll be able to see this as maybe some way to get around you know, the fact that we can break, for example, RSA using quantum computers. Okay, so last time we talked about fault tolerance, and you know, we said, you know, that the basic idea, if we wanted to be able to compute in the presence of noise, would be that we would encode our quantum information into quantum error correcting codes, and then we would compute on the encrypted on the encoded data. And in order to do that, you know, we would have to think carefully about the particular way we would choose to do the encoded gates. We talked a little bit about that last time. But you know, we want to design some way of doing the gates on our encoded data so that errors won't accumulate too badly. That's you know, there's some sort of design principle that you have to be careful about how you do your encoded gates. So then you know, supposing that you can do that, so supposing you have some way of performing these gates on your encoded data, then you know, how is this going to work? You know, what can we say about the what will happen to the error rate when we have some encoding? All right, so here's the you know, the strategy for fault tolerant computing. You know, quantum computing, although you can think about similar ideas even in the context of classical computing. So we're going to have some model for what we mean by errors in the computation. And you know, a simple one would be that there's some kind of error, like say, you know, depolarizing noise, that's applied to every qubit every time we do anything. So when we act with it on a gate, or when we're just storing it, you know, so at every time interval, there's going to be some probability p that some, you know, let's say some depolarizing error happens, you know, independently on every qubit. So so suppose the probability of error per gate is p. P is some number that quantifies the strength of the noise, and we only want to be able to say that we can make things fault tolerant for probabilities of error that are small enough. Of course, we won't be able to, you know, if there's a very high probability of error per gate, then that's just not something we would expect to be able to correct against. So we're interested in some sort of limit where P is small, and we'd like small to just mean below some small constant value. All right, now what we're going to do is we're going to construct our logical gates in some way that the probability of error per gate is, you know, in the encoded system is quadratically better, right? So we construct an encoding, and along with that encoding, we have to construct a way of doing logical gates, you know, so some scheme for performing logical gates. So when you look at the level of the encoded data, now the probability of error per gate will be at most, you know, let's say some constant times p squared. Error probability per now encoded gate, so per logical gate, is at most, let's say, c times p squared, right? So now what this says is that if the probability of error, so if p is small enough, then this will be an improvement, right? So if we have p less than 1 over c, this is an improvement. So, you know, if we can do this for any constant c, then there'll be some constant threshold, 1 over c, for which this does better. Now, it doesn't make the, you know, it does better. That doesn't mean that the result is effectively noiseless, but at least we've made things better. Okay. Now, you know, there's a lot of detail that goes into, you know, how you would design such a scheme and how you would calculate c. You basically have to think about all the sort of patterns of errors that could occur in your error model and, you know, what that would do. At the level of you know, errors on the logical operations, there's really a lot of kind of detailed analysis that would go into estimating such a thing. That's, you know, the kind of thing we don't have time to talk about here, but you could certainly imagine that such a thing is done. It's harder than just, you know, the fact that if you encode things in an error correcting code and then you consider, you know, having single qubit errors with probability p, that the error rate goes like now p squared, because now you have to worry about the fact that there can be errors occurring, you know, when you're doing things like, syndrome extraction and stuff like that that we assumed was perfect before. But you can, I'm just going to claim that you can construct ways of doing the encoding and the logical gates and the syndrome extraction, et cetera, so that something like this holds. So now, supposing that we have this, so we can make things better by encoding our system, what we would really like to do is make things arbitrarily good, because this is just going to make the probability of error smaller. But if we want to do a very long computation, we'd really like the error rate per we'd really like to be able to make the error rate per gate arbitrarily small, right? Because if we want to do an arbitrarily long computation, but we have some even some small constant probability of error every time we do a gate, by the end of the time, by the end of the entire computation, we'll just have junk, right? So if we wanted to be able to do a very long computation, we have to be able to make the effective error probability smaller and smaller as the length of the computation grows. So we have to do something more than this, right? So any ideas? What could we do that would make things better?
Re-encode,
right. So we could just take, you could say just like try to come up with a better encoding scheme, use better codes. But that it's sort of not clear how you would do that in general. But we can do what you suggested, which is just to use what we already know and just re-encode using exactly the same code. And then that will make things, that will make the success probability even better. And if we want to make the error probability smaller and smaller, we can just concatenate the code more and more times. So this is the general strategy of making something arbitrarily fault tolerant, or at least it's a general strategy that can be made to work, which is what are called concatenated codes. Right. Okay, so the strategy, or a strategy for arbitrarily small error, is concatenation. Okay, so now, there's something that you're going to have to worry about when you do this, which is that if we concatenate to a certain number of levels, every time we, so let's say that what we're doing, let's say that we have such a scheme where we encode our qubits in the 7-qubit code, right? So when we do this once, we multiply the number of qubits in our circuit by 7, because every physical qubit has gotten encoded, every logical qubit at the logical level has been encoded into 7 physical qubits. But now if we do this again, every one of those physical qubits in the first encoding is going to get replaced with 7 qubits. So now we have 49 qubits for every one of our original logical qubits. And as we concatenate to some number of levels, the number of qubits that we need is going to go up exponentially. Right? So that might seem like a bad thing. So the number of qubits goes up exponentially with the number of levels of concatenation. So why is that not a problem? Well, the error probability is going to go down even faster, right? So the error probability is going to actually go down doubly exponentially. So, if you want to get to some small error rate, you won't have to go to very many levels of concatenation at all. You'll only have to go sort of, to logarithmically many levels, so that this overhead will really be only polynomial. Okay, so the error rate goes down doubly exponentially, right? Because you can see this, I guess, because the number of qubits is being multiplied by some factor every time, but the error probability is getting squared every time. Right, so things are even better. So the error rate is going down doubly exponentially, and so this means that you don't have to go to too many levels. And what you can show, if you sort of analyze what's going on carefully, is what is the overhead going to be in terms of the number of qubits that you need to have and the number of gates that you need to perform. Well, if you fix some error rate epsilon that you want to achieve, you can show that the overhead is polynomial in the log of 1 over epsilon. So you only need some additional overhead that goes like not even like 1 over epsilon, but with like the log of 1 over epsilon. So you can get really a very small error as a function you can get a very small error without having to increase the number of gates too much. So the behavior is similar to what we saw in the Soloveitchi-Taieff theorem that we talked about. very beginning of the course. And it'll also be polynomial in the log of the number of original gates. So even when you think about you know, the fact that you have to encode things fault tolerantly, still, even polynomial improvements, like the improvement that we got from Grover's algorithm, these will be will still be preserved under you know, these fault tolerant encodings. So you know, it may be that if we want to do things fault tolerantly, instead of like square root of n gates, we need like square root of n times log n gates, something like that. But we won't lose the quadratic improvement. Okay, so that's good. And now what you can say, so there's like a fairly general theorem that you can prove, which, you know, theorems of this kind will depend on what error model you assume, but you can prove such a theorem for many error models, which is what's called the threshold theorem, or the fault-tolerant threshold theorem. And what this theorem says is that if the initial, like the physical error rate is p, then you can always do this. So you can always make the effective error rate as small as you want with only this kind of overhead, provided p is small enough, right? So if p is too big, if p is some, you know, bigish constant, then maybe you won't be able to do this. But there will be some threshold value of p, such that if p is below that threshold, then you will be able to do things fault tolerantly. You will be able to concatenate the code and get an error rate which is arbitrarily small, and the overhead in doing so won't be too bad. So yeah, let me just say this works if the physical error rate is below some threshold. Now, what that threshold is will also depend a lot on things like, well, what the error model is, of course, and also on things like what's the architecture of your quantum computer, right? So to be able to do this, you will have to be able to do gates in parallel, because you know, you'll need to be doing things simultaneously in different parts of the computer. But you know, so for example, if you have an architecture for your computer where you can, in one time step, you know, you're allowed to perform gates between two qubits that are located in some arbitrary position in the computer, then you know, that's sort of like a pretty strong assumption, and then it might be easier to prove such a theorem. You can even prove such a thing if you have a local architecture where, say, you have qubits arranged in you know, two-dimensional grid or something like that, and in one time step you can only perform gates between adjacent qubits. So it's harder to deal with such a model, but you can prove such a theorem in such a model. Now, you may get a worse threshold, right? So if you have additional constraints, the threshold that you're able to prove may not be as good. But you know, you can consider those sorts of situations and see how the threshold depends on what constraints you might have on your architecture. You know, I can't really give you a number for the value of this threshold because it depends a lot on the you know, details of your system, and also just on you know, the quality of your analysis as well. But sort of the kinds of numbers that you could prove for this threshold theorem would be something like, you know, maybe if the error rate per gate is less than a part in a thousand, then maybe you can prove something. And there are other issues that you have to worry about, you know, in these thresholds. So like the closer your actual error rate is to the threshold, the more this overhead is going to be. So there's going to be a trade-off in general between, you know, how far away you are from the threshold and how much overhead there is in the you know, in the encoding. And there are lots of issues here to worry about. But the basic thing to know just is that there is some kind of a threshold theorem that you can prove. And this is nice if you want to think about, you know, if you're a person like me who wants to think about quantum algorithms and not have to worry about noise, because now you can just say, okay, I'm going to assume that my quantum computer is effectively noiseless, and I'll just appeal to this threshold theorem to sort of argue that that's going to be a realistic thing in many implementations. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about fault-tolerant computing. Are there any questions about this? If you do have more questions later on, you know, you have a great local expert here in Daniel Gosman, who's really one of the people who's contributed a lot to this theory of error correction and fault tolerance, and you know, could tell you a lot about it. You can also ask me questions. All right. Then the last topic we're going to talk about is quantum key distribution. All right, so this is going to be you know, another sort of thing that we can do with quantum information. It's not a computational task, but rather it's going to be some cryptographic task that allows us to do something that's in this case not possible at all using classical information. So we've seen computational things where you could do something a lot faster with a quantum computer than with a classical computer. But in the context of computation, you could always simulate a quantum computer with exponential overhead, classically. But here, this is going to be something that you can do with quantum information that you just can't do at all with classical information. So in some sense, it's an even more dramatic example of the difference between what you can do classically and what you can do quantumly for information processing. And this is also something that maybe would be practically significant if you wanted to actually have secure communications. And in fact, it's also one of the easiest things to realize with present-day technology. So you can actually buy commercial systems that do quantum key distribution. At least, there are companies that sell these systems. I don't know if there are really people who are buying them, other than people in research labs who are interested in sort of understanding how they work and whether they can make side channel attacks and things like that. But in principle, you can buy such a system. And if you're paranoid enough about your communications to want to have a lot of security, then you could use one of these systems. Okay, so this is going to be some kind of an alternative to public key cryptography, right? So much of the cryptography that's used today is based on this idea of public key cryptography, like this RSA scheme that we discussed before, where you have separate public and private keys, where there's a public key that's used for encryption and a private key that's used for decryption, that's kept private by the receiver. But schemes of this kind, there are many different schemes of this kind, but they all have the common feature that they rely on computational assumptions, right? So for RSA, the assumption is that factoring is a hard computational problem. But as we saw, that's not a good assumption if we bring quantum computers into the picture. So we would like to not make those assumptions. And any such assumption, it's generally going to be an unproven assumption because we don't know how to prove that computational problems are hard. And so those sorts of schemes will always be on shaky ground. We might like to, come up with a problem that we believe, even more strongly is hard than factoring. And there are examples of problems that we don't know how to solve efficiently, even with a quantum computer. And you can try to use those to build cryptosystems. And there are examples of such things, like what are called lattice-based cryptosystems. But we don't know. Someone could come up with a quantum algorithm for those cryptosystems, tomorrow. Or someone could even come up with a classical algorithm that would break those cryptosystems tomorrow. So something that would be really nice would be if instead of having computational assumptions, we could have a system that we could really prove was secure. Right? So maybe I should write something about this. So if we consider public key crypto, in general, this will rely on unproven hardness assumptions. So what we could ask is instead, could we have what we would call information theoretic security, where we don't have any assumptions about the hardness of certain computational problems, but we can just show on sort of information theoretic grounds that it's just not possible to break the crypto system. Okay, and it turns out that there is a way to have information theoretic security, even classically, but there's a heavy price to be paid for it. The price to be paid is that you need to have a really long secret key that you can use to do the encryption. So here's an alternative to public key cryptography, which is sometimes called private key cryptography. Private key cryptography, where there's no public key, there's only a private key, which has to be shared between the sender and the receiver. And this is sometimes also called the one-time pad. So this is a classical encryption scheme, which is which is provably secure. I mean, there's just no way in principle to break it. But the downside is that in order to establish such a system, in order to use such a system, there's a very large cost in terms of some information that the two parties who want to exchange messages would have to put up with. Okay, so the setting is the following: we have two parties, Alice and Bob, and let's say Alice wants to send messages to Bob. Okay, but there might be some eavesdropper listening in on the channel. That's a these are the names we usually give to these parties, Alice and Bob, and Eve is the eavesdropper. Okay, so how does this scheme work? So Alice, let's say, wants to send some message to Bob. And let's say M is like an n-bit message, so it has bits M1 through MN. She wants to send this n-bit message to Bob. So if they want to do this in this one key, in this one-time pad cryptosystem, the way that they're going to do that is they're going to have a secret key whose length is the same as the message. Right? So if they want to send a very long message, they're going to need a very long secret key. Right? So they share a secret key, k. So they're going to be n key bits, k1 through kn. And the assumption will be that these bits are chosen uniformly at random. So they created these bits by flipping fair coins. And they did this in such a way that the eavesdropper has no information about the key. Okay, so with each ki uniformly random, and known only to Alice and Bob. Okay, so one way to create such a key, of course, is that Alice and Bob meet in some secure location where they believe that no one can see what they're doing. They flip some coins. They each write down the whether the coins come up heads or tails, and then they put the document where all of these zeros and ones are written down in a very secure briefcase. They handcuff it to their wrists, and then they go back to wherever it is that they live and where they might want to later send secret messages. Right, and really, distributing such a key would have to be done in such a way that they meet, and they really have, security over they really are sure that the place where they meet is secure, and that when they go off to their separate locations, they have to maintain that no one can look at the key along the way. So it's important that this key really be something which is secure, and it's necessary for Alice and Bob to meet. If they only have the ability to send classical information, it's necessary for them to meet in order to establish such a key, right? I guess it should be kind of clear that there's no way for them to create such a key without meeting, just exchanging classical messages. Because, a very, naive and kind of stupid thing that they could do would be, Alice could just flip the coins on her own, and then she could call Bob up on the phone and, read him the values, right? But the idea here is that if they're far apart from each other, then there could always be someone listening in on the communications channel. So if they do that, the eavesdropper could learn what the key is, and now the system's not going to be secure anymore. So really, they have to meet to do this. To establish the key. Okay, so that's the sense in which this scheme is kind of expensive. They have to meet to establish the key, and they have to establish a lot of key, right? So if they want to be able to send n bits, they need to establish an n-bit key. And if they, establish, a million bits of key, and then they, exchange some messages and they use up the whole key, you can't reuse the bits of the key. Every time you send a different bit of the message, you have to use a new bit of key. So if they send a million bits, then, and then they want to exchange more messages, there's just nothing that they can do until they meet again and establish more key. All right, but now let's suppose at least that they have this key. They have this n-bit key if they want to send an n-bit message. Let me explain how the one-time pad works. Maybe you can guess, even if you haven't seen this before. So what they're going to do is they're going to create some ciphertext. So the ciphertext that Alice is going to create from her message is just that she's going to XOR each of the bits with the key. So there's going to be a bit of ciphertext CI, which is just the ith message bit XORed with the ith key bit. And now, as far as an eavesdropper who doesn't know what the key bits are is concerned, the bits of the ciphertext are just uniformly random. Because I've just taken some bits MI. I mean, it could be the L0 string. It could be an arbitrary message. No matter what these message bits are, if you choose basically XORing with these random key bits from the perspective of someone who doesn't know what the key bits are, that's equivalent to just choosing with probability half to keep the bit the same, or with probability a half to flip it. So in other words, the distribution of ci, of the bit ci, you know, if you don't know what ki is, the distribution of ci is just uniform, right? It's equally likely to be 0 or 1. So that really knows, really carries no information. There's some sort of entropic measure, which is what's called the mutual information, that you can use to formalize this. And you can say that the mutual information between the bit ci and mi is 0, right, if you don't know what ki is. Okay, so there's just no information in C about M in the absence of knowledge about K. So that's the sense in which this scheme is information theoretically secure. If all you see is CI and you don't know anything about MI or KI, then you can't infer, you cannot infer what MI is from CI. So Eve can't learn anything about CI about MI from CI, or more generally about the whole message M from the whole ciphertext string C. But on the other hand, Bob, who knows what the key is, can easily decode the message because he just does the same thing as the encryption. He just XORs with KI again, right? So CI XORed with KI is clearly just MI. So Bob can recover the message. So that's how this one-time pad works, and you know, it's information theoretically secure, but it's very expensive because you have to create a lot of key, and the only way to create the key is by meeting. All right. So now, where does quantum mechanics come into the picture? So it turns out that if you have a quantum mechanical channel, if Alice can send quantum states to Bob, then it's possible to establish this secret key without ever meeting. So they'll be able to create the secret key just by sending quantum states, even if they're far apart. So there'll be no, you know, having to meet in some undisclosed location and walk around with a briefcase handcuffed to themselves. They'll be able to sit comfortably in their own labs and just exchange quantum states. Actually, they'll only have to send quantum states in one direction, and also exchange some classical messages. And they will be able to establish a key that they can be confident that no eavesdropper knows anything about. So that's a way of doing information theoretically secure communication by generating this key and then applying this classical protocol. Okay, so QKD avoids the need to meet to establish a key. So they can remotely distribute the key. Now there is something else that they're going to need. So they'll need the ability to send quantum states. As I said, you'll only need to be able to send them in one direction. And they will also need an authenticated classical channel. So they'll need to have the ability to send classical messages back and forth, where they won't necessarily have to assume that no one's listening. So it could be a channel over which Eve could read the information going through that channel. But they want it to be authentic in the sense that when Bob receives a message from Alice, she knows that it's really Alice who sent the message. So this is something that you need to do to prevent what's called a man in the middle attack, where Alice thinks she's establishing a secret key with Bob, but she's actually establishing a secret key with Eve. And then when she sends the messages, Eve will be able to read them because she's the one who created the key. So they'll need also an authenticated classical channel. So in other words, we're going to assume that they know who the messages are coming from. This is also something that you can create even if you have an insecure classical channel, if you have a little bit of randomness. So one way of thinking about this protocol is that it's not so much a way of creating the key from nothing, but it's a way of expanding the key. So if they have some small seed of key that they can use to do this initial authentication, then they can use quantum key distribution to generate an arbitrarily long key. So maybe they really do need to meet in secret to establish a few random bits, but not a lot of them. Okay. All right, so this is what we're going to assume, that they can send qubits. Let's say Alice can send qubits to Bob, and that they have this authenticated classical channel. So here's the basic idea of this scheme, which is what's called the BB84 protocol. So this is the first protocol that was proposed for doing quantum key distribution, and it's also one of the simplest. All right, so this is going to be just kind of the basic idea of the protocol, and we'll have to expand on this a little bit more later in terms of what they would actually do, but here's sort of the core of how the protocol works. Okay, so Alice is going to send some quantum state to Bob that's going to encode some information they're going to use to create a key, and something that they can do is create either states in the computational basis or the Hadamard transform basis. So she's going to choose random states from 0, 1, plus, minus. So she doesn't have to be able to create very complicated quantum states. And you'll see later on that also the measurements they have to do are not that complicated either. So this is why this protocol is something that's going to be feasible with current technology. Because the sorts of things you have to do are much simpler than the sorts of things you would have to do to do universal quantum computing. You're not going to have to hold on to quantum states for very long. You're not going to have to be able to do complicated multi-qubit gates. You're not even going to have to prepare, you know, very complicated single-qubit states. So this is why it's technologically feasible to do this, even using the sorts of devices we're able to build now. Okay, and then what Alice does with this state that she creates is she sends it to Bob. And she sends it through an insecure quantum channel, right? So the eavesdropper could potentially intercept the signal and manipulate it in some way and send it on. She could also, of course, she could just block the channel and have it be that nothing arrives at Bob. And there's no way to protect against something like that. I mean, an eavesdropper who wants to just cut the communications channel can keep them from establishing secret key. But the sort of thing we want to establish is that, there's some protocol that they can go through such that if some tests are passed, they'll be confident that the key that they get is truly secret. Okay, so Alice sends the state to Bob, and then Bob is going to measure in some basis. So Bob is going to randomly choose whether to measure in the computational basis or the Hadamard transform basis. Okay, so Bob measures in the basis 0, 1, or plus, minus, chosen uniformly at random. Okay. And now, what's the idea? So after Bob does these measurements, so certainly not before, but after he does these measurements, he chooses which basis to measure in, and he remembers which basis he made each of the measurements in. And after all of the measurements are completed, what they'll do is they'll publicly compare the bases. So so Bob will reveal publicly the information about whether he measured in this basis or this basis. He won't reveal what outcome he got, but he'll reveal the basis. And Alice will also reveal whether she prepared a state from this basis, 0, 1, or a state from this basis, plus, minus. And she certainly won't say what was the state that she sent. That would be a bad thing to do. But she'll reveal what was the basis. Okay. And then what they'll do is they'll publicly compare their bases. So they'll do this comparison over the authenticated classical channel. So they'll be sure that it's really them who are talking. But it's possible that some eavesdropper will be listening, but that's okay. They'll just reveal the bases information, and they'll try to see what were the cases where they measured in the same basis. Okay, so Alice and Bob publicly compare their bases. And they're only going to keep the states corresponding to the cases where Alice and so Bob measured in the basis that was the same basis that Alice prepared the states in, right? So if Alice happened to prepare a 0 and Bob measured in the plus minus basis, there's not really going to be any information in the outcomes that he got, because at least the distribution should have been that both the outcomes were equally likely. And so that's not something that they're going to keep. They're only going to keep the outcomes corresponding to where, let's say, Alice prepared one of these two states, and then Bob happened to choose the correct basis to measure in. And that's going to happen half the time on average. So they're not going to throw much away in doing this. They're only going to throw away about half of the outcomes. So they're going to only keep the cases where B measured in the basis Alice prepared a state in. Okay. So it's really important that this information about the bases is only shared after the after the measurement has been performed, right? So if they were, if Bob would somehow say ahead of time what bases he was going to measure in, then the eavesdropper might know what bases she should measure in order to well, she could make a measurement and then forward the signal on, and that wouldn't be detected because Bob is going to measure in the same bases that she did. But because they don't do that, because this information is only revealed later, if the eavesdropper wants to try to measure and try to get some information about the state, well, you know, the eavesdropper is going to have to choose a basis to measure in. A simple attack would be to choose either this basis or this basis to measure in, and you know, half the time she'll measure in a different basis from Bob. So in the cases where she happens to measure in the same basis, then she gets some information. But half the time she's going to measure in the wrong basis, and that can be detected, right? Because if Alice and Bob, if Alice is prepared to state in the 0-1 basis, and then Bob measures in the 0-1 basis, but in between the eavesdropper measured in the plus-minus basis, then it could be that even though Alice prepared the state 0, Bob got the state 1. So because of there's some sort of fundamental trade-off between trying to get information about a quantum state and disturbing it, if the eavesdropper is going to try to get some information from the quantum states, in general, she'll be disturbing them, and that will be something that they can detect. Right? So something else, of course, an eavesdropper could try to do would be to maybe make some kind of a copy of the state, but we know that that's not possible from no cloning, so that's not something that's going to work. She could try to copy the information in a fixed basis, but she really needs to, in some sense, copy the information in both of these bases in order to be able to get information in a way that's not going to be detected, and that's something that's just not possible. So in two bases of non-orthogonal states, you can't copy the information in both of those bases. Okay. So this is the basic idea, and let's think about a simple attack that the eavesdropper could make. Right, so I guess this is what I was just explaining a little bit in passing, but let's think about it a little bit more carefully. This is what's called intercept resend. Okay, so a simple attack that they could make, that Eve could make, would be that she's going to choose at random whether to measure in the 0-1 basis or the plus-minus basis, and then she's going to get some information and she's going to send the state on. And in the cases where she happened to measure in the same basis that Alice prepared the state in and that Bob measured the state in, then that will go undetected. So something that she could do, I guess she doesn't have to choose to measure in a random basis because the bases are being chosen at random anyway. So something that she could do would be just to always choose to measure in a fixed basis. So Eve could measure in the 0-1 basis. And if that happens to be the correct basis, then this will go undetected. So if the basis is correct, meaning that Alice prepared such a state, and and Bob measured in this basis, then she's going to learn a bit of the key, right? So the way they're going to create this key is that Alice and Bob are going to make this measurement, and then they're going to choose whether to set that key bit to be 0 or 1, depending upon what the outcome was. And that's something they'll know because Alice knows what state she prepared, and Bob knows what outcome he got. So then Eve will learn a bit of key. Okay, but if the basis is wrong, then Alice and Bob's answers will actually differ with probability a half. So in other words, the key bit that the bit that they think the key should be will actually not be the same. And they can detect some eavesdropping. But how will they detect this, right? So we have to maybe think a little bit about this, because if they would announce the information about what their key bits are in order, over this authenticated but but authenticated classical channel, which is authentic, but where the eavesdropper could be listening, then that's a bit that they can't use as key, right? So if they would just announce what all of their key bits are over this channel, that would be, again, really bad. But what they can do is just do some checks, right? So they're going to keep some of the bits that they're going to hopefully be able to use as key, and then they'll sacrifice some bits that they'll use just to detect eavesdropping. So they'll create some bits that they think should be good key bits, and then they'll do a check to see whether they're truly the same. So they'll announce over this authenticated channel whether they got the same outcome. And if they get the same thing, then they get a little bit of confidence that there was that it was unlikely that eavesdropping was occurring. But if they get a different result, you know, something they could do then would be to abort, because they know, okay, this should never happen if there's no eavesdropping. So that means, so if they get different answers, then there must be some eavesdropping going on. And then they can just abort the protocol, right? And sort of not be fooled into creating a key that an eavesdropper has some information about. Okay, but there's a problem with that strategy, right? Because suppose that what they do is they do this check and they abort every time they get something that's inconsistent. Well, then if they try to run this protocol in practice, they're never going to generate any key, right? Because in a realistic system, even when there's no eavesdropping going on, there's still going to be some errors in the channel. The channel will not be perfect. And so just because of the noise in the channel, sometimes when they do these checks, they could be getting different answers. And now they have to sort of try to guess whether this lack of lack of agreement between the qubits that they got, whether that's due to noise in the channel or whether it's due to eavesdropping. And there's actually no way to tell whether this lack of agreement was due to noise or eavesdropping. Really, to be sort of paranoid about what's going on, they should always attribute it to eavesdropping, right? So they should always attribute this difference to eavesdropping, because it could be that in some sense, like, the reason that the bits are not agreeing is because maybe the environment learned something about the key. But if we assume an all-powerful eavesdropper, as we probably should if we're being careful cryptographers, then the information somehow is there in the environment about what the key bit is. So we might as well assume that the eavesdropper knows what that is. So they really should be attributing all of the effects of noise to eavesdropping. But now, what are they going to do in a realistic situation where these bits are not always agreeing? They want to somehow be able to take a scheme like this and make it robust in the presence of noise. And there's, again, going to be something going on kind of like fault tolerance, where if the noise rate is low enough and they modify the protocol in some way, then they'll be able to be confident that an eavesdropper could have learned no information about the final key that they create. Okay? So we have to somehow improve this protocol a little bit to take account of the possibility of noise. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you what the full protocol actually is that will work in the presence of noise, and that, as long as the error rate is not too high, will allow them to create secret key. Okay, so here's the full BB84 protocol, which will works even with sufficiently small noise. Okay, so the first thing they're going to do is they're going to perform something exactly like what was described here. They're going to do this n times, and that's going to give them something like n over 2 bits of candidate key, right? So remember that when they do this, we would expect that half the time Alice and Bob would measure in different bases, and so they're just not going to keep those results at all. So if they do this n times, they're only going to get about n over 2 bits of not necessarily key that they'll be able to keep at the end, but of sort of candidate key. Okay, so they repeat the basic unit n times to get about n over 2 key bits, right? So these bits, let me put key bits in quotes, because they're not key bits that they'll be able to finally keep as key at the end of the day, but they'll be the bits that they would get if they would carry out this protocol, and what they would find is that they would measure in the same basis, and so Alice would have a key bit, which was the state that she prepared, and Bob would have a key bit, which is the state that he measured. And those two bits might not agree, because there might be some noise in the channel. So that's one reason they don't want to use those bits necessarily as part of the final key. And also, it could be that if some of the noise was due to eavesdropping, that an eavesdropper has some information about the key. So there's kind of two problems that they have to deal with. Their keys may not agree, and the eavesdropper may have some amount of information about the key, and they would like to squash that. They would like to get it so that the eavesdropper doesn't have, has an arbitrarily small amount of information about the key. So it really has no information about even any one bit of key. Okay, so here's what they're going to do. They're going to do some tests to try to estimate what the error rate is. Okay, so Alice is going to choose some subset of her bits, and just to be concrete, let's say she chooses half of the remaining bits. So she takes n over 4 bits, and she's going to use those to do some kind of checks. And so what she's going to do is she's just going to announce over the authenticated channel what the values were, what the states were that she prepared for those bases. Okay, so these definitely are going to be bits that we're just sacrificing. We're not going to use these in the key. We're just using them to do tests. This factor of 2 is not necessarily, so taking half of these bits is not necessarily the best thing to do if you want to get the highest rate of key, but I'm just picking some particular value just to make things concrete. Okay, so she's going to choose a subset of n over 4 bits, and she's going to announce which bits they were and what the values were, so what the state was that she prepared. She announces their locations and values. Okay, and then but what Bob is going to do is some comparisons, right? So they've done this over this authenticated channel. He knows what these values are, and so he's going to he's going to check to see whether that agreed with what he got. And if there's some noise in the channel, definitely he will not get the same thing for every one of those bits. But what he's going to do is he's going to estimate some sort of empirical error rate, right? This is going to allow him to get a good estimate of what the error rate per bit for the channel was. So so Bob compares to his outcomes, and he's going to estimate an error rate. So he just looks at how many of the, how many of his corresponding bits were in agreement with the states that Alice chose to prepare, and now what they're going to do is that if this error rate is above some threshold, they're going to abort, right? So if the rate is above some threshold, and the sort of threshold that that they might be able to pick would be maybe something like 20%. This is something which is going to depend on maybe the details of what exactly you do, but there's some analysis to be done to figure out what is the right number for the threshold. Here it's a bit more, it's quite a bit more straightforward than in the case of fault tolerance, but there's some threshold rate such that if they have fewer than that number of errors, they're okay, and if they're above that threshold, then they should just say, whoa, there's too much eavesdropping going on, I can't be confident that there's going to be any secret key left, So I'm just going to abort, okay? And that always, that's something, the possibility that they might just not get out any secret key is just something we can't guard against. I mean, if the eavesdropper just decides that they're going to cut the communications channel or just, they're going to do this intercept or send thing and they're going to be like measuring every time, then that's a situation in which you just have to abort, right? That's something you have to be able to detect. But that's something that we're going to consider to be okay. Because there's just no way around that, and what we want is that in the hopefully likely situation that actually no one was listening and you're just kind of being careful, then as long as you can create a channel that doesn't have too much error in it, and this is probably pretty reasonable, then you'll be able to do this and you'll be able to be confident that what you get out is secure. Okay, so if this error rate is too high, then they abort. And now suppose the error rate is not too high, then they're going to continue, and they're going to do some further processing, right? So it's not necessarily, it wouldn't be a good idea now to just say, okay, take the other n over 4 bits that Alice didn't announce and assume those are all okay if this error rate was maybe only 19%, right? That would be a bad thing because then certainly it could be that basically all of this error was due to eavesdropping and, so the eavesdropper could have some substantial fraction of information about the remaining key if they were doing a lot of eavesdropping. Okay, so you don't want to just use the rest of the key bits as they are, but you have to do some further processing. And there are going to be two steps that they use to do this. So the first one is what's called information reconciliation. So what they're going to do here is try to, you know, take care of the fact that some of their key bits won't agree. I guess that's another reason they shouldn't just use the remaining key bits as they are, because they might not even all agree, right? And if they don't have the same key bit, then the protocol won't work. So they have to do something so that they have a key that they really agree on, right? So there are no key bits where they disagree. So what they're going to do here is, you know, they don't want to do any more just like direct comparison of one bit with another, because then they have to announce those bits, and that's something that you know, the eavesdropper would get to know, so that would be bad. But what they can do instead is they can use something which is in the spirit of error correcting codes, like classical error correcting codes. They can compare the parities of subsets of their bits and try to see whether those parities are the same. And on the basis of those parity checks, they can do some corrections that would make their bits actually agree. Okay, so Alice and Bob are going to compare parities of subsets of their remaining bits. And they're going to use these. They're going to use these to correct errors in the. You're going to use these to correct errors in the you know, other bits that they have. And also, every time they exchange a parity, that's one bit of information that they've revealed to the eavesdropper. And so they're going to have to discard you know, one corresponding bit of the key. So Alice and Bob are going to compare parities of subsets of their remaining bits and use this information to correct bit flips. So, you know, this is basically, they're going to be doing something using error correcting codes, the details of which we can't go into about how exactly you would do this, but they'll do something involving error correcting codes, and they're going to discard one bit of key for every parity that they reveal. Because the only way for them to you know, what these parities are is to you know, exchange them over an insecure classical channel. Okay. Oh, yes. Well, in the previous step, they were just trying to estimate an empirical error rate, right? And they're not using that information to do any correction, right? So. Well, it's pretty different, right? So in the previous step, they're just revealing all of the bits. In this step, they're revealing some kind of collective information about a subset of many of the bits. So they're only exchanging the parity, not the individual bits.
Okay, but it's not one parity, not one bit of parity information per bit, is it?
That's right. I mean, so, you know, I haven't said here how many you know, how many parity bits they're going to exchange, but it's certainly not that. I mean, if you were sending somehow one bit of parity for every bit of these n over two bits, then that would be the same as just revealing what all of the bits are. So the number of bits of parity that they exchange is going to be something which is small compared to the total number of, you know. So now there are n over four bits remaining, and they're not going to send n over four parity bits. They're going to send, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's probably some smaller constant fraction. So that the things that they're exchanging are like some collective information about all of the bits, and they're not sending information about any one particular bit. But now, I mean, when I say they have to discard one bit of key, what I mean is that if they exchange this parity, you know, in this information theoretic sense, the eavesdropper has learned one bit of information. So like the mutual information between the parities that she sees and the bits that they share is going to go down by one when she learns this parity. So that's like the amount of information in sort of the Shannon sense that they're going to lose by doing. Yes.
So it seems like when you make this claim that in order that you have to discard one of the key bits after you've revealed a bit of information about the parities,
right?
You're kind of saying that like a bit is a bit, why couldn't you say the same thing about how much they actually gain from this? Instead, if you reveal one bit of parity information,
right,
you're only gaining one bit of the key.
The eavesdropper is only gaining one bit of the key?
That the Alice and Bob are gaining one bit of agreement in the key.
Well,
Well, they already have the, you know, they already have these, they share these strings, right? And there's some, they have some confidence that these strings are actually maybe close to the same thing, right? They, if the empirical error rate that they estimated was something low, then they expect that actually a lot of their bits agree. So they're just trying to get, you know, they have two strings that are likely to be pretty close, and they just want to get a little bit of information about where they differ, right? Whereas the eavesdropper, to learn the key, would somehow have to learn more. Right? The eavesdropper has, you know, Alice and Bob have a lot of mutual information with each other, but Eve has hopefully less, and when they estimate this empirical error rate, that sort of, I mean, if we want to think in information theoretic terms, that allows them to say something about how much mutual information Eve would have. And basically, if they have some advantage, you know, if they have more mutual information with each other than Eve has with their keys, then, you know, they want to somehow distill that into some key that's really, you know, definitely, where the keys are definitely the same and where Eve has very little information about them. So after this step, you know, after they've done this information reconciliation, then you can choose the parameters such that they're quite sure that they have the same key. But the problem is that now the eavesdropper may have some information about it, right? Because she has some information that, you know, they sort of estimated in the third bullet point how much information Eve would have about their key. And then she learns some further information because of these parodies. So they're going to have to discard some bits in order to, you know, they're going to have to somehow reduce the size of the key. They're going to have to distill the information down to something smaller in order to have something that Eve has no information about. And there are two places that comes from, right? One is that Eve initially had some information about the key because they attributed, or you know, they would assume, you know, conservatively that she had some information about the key because they attribute all of this error to eavesdropping on the channel. And then they just reveal some more information themselves, one bit for every parity that they exchange in this step. So now the last step of the protocol is going to be to do what's called privacy amplification, to get out some key about which they can be sure that Eve has very little information. Okay, so that's the last step, privacy amplification. So the problem here is that you have some shared string that, you know, now you're quite confident that it's really the same string that Alice and Bob have, but Eve has some mutual information with that string. She knows something about what that string is, like, for example, she knows the parodies of some subsets, and that means you're going to have to discard something. And there's also some other information that you want to, you know, sort of remove from what Eve has. So what they're going to do is they're going to produce the final key by having the final key bits just be the parodies of randomly chosen subsets of these bits that they have now, these N-over-4 bits that they have remaining. So Alice and Bob are going to compute parities of random subsets of their bits . So this is, you know, using a technique that's what's called hashing, and they're going to use this to produce the final key bits. And the reason that they do this is to ensure that the eavesdropper really has very little information. She really can't guess with any substantial probability even what one bit of the key is. So about which Eve has arbitrarily little information. I mean, there's going to be some security parameter that you have to worry about how to set if you want to ensure that, you know, the amount of information she could get about any one bit is extremely small, and that would maybe say something about how much information you would have to hash down to. But, you know, if you want to make the amount of information arbitrarily small, you can always do that by choosing your parameters appropriately. So you want it to be that she couldn't even guess what one bit was with any substantial probability, and you can ensure that by hashing things down. Okay, so that's the basic protocol. You can see that it's something that you could really try to carry out with kind of present day technology, and it sort of seems like, at least, this should really be a secure scheme, right? So at least I've kind of tried to intuitively argue that you're covering all your bases, that, you know, any place that Eve might try to use some knowledge of the information that's been exchanged in order to get some information about the key. You handle that by some appropriate processing. But it turns out that you can actually prove that this is secure. So this was done quite a bit after the initial protocol, right? So this thing is called BB84 because this protocol was proposed in 1984, even before, long before things like Shor's algorithm. And it was proven in 2000 that this scheme is secure in a paper by Shor and Pressel. So this protocol can be proven secure. Now, when you say that you want to prove something that something is secure, of course, you have to have some mathematical model of what's going on. And you prove that it's secure within some model, right? So within some model of the devices, the channel, etc. Right, so you have to make some assumptions about what's going on that you can state in mathematical terms in order to prove that this thing is secure. And so that's an important caveat. But if you make some particular model of what is going on in the protocol, then you can give a security proof. And we don't have time to do this now because we're already out of time. But this proof is quite interesting and actually uses some of the things that we've talked about already. So for example, even though there's no encoding in quantum error correcting code that's going on explicitly in what I discussed, in the proof of security, you can sort of show that what they're doing is equivalent to something where they would encode something in a quantum error correcting code. This also relates to the problem of entanglement purification, something like this entanglement concentration that we talked about, but where you have mixed quantum states instead. So it relates to some other kind of interesting topics in quantum information, and using some of those ideas, you can actually prove that this protocol is secure. But one thing which is kind of maybe not totally desirable about those sorts of proofs is, as I said, they assume some sort of model of the devices, and you could try to do something which would be even better. And there will always be what are called side channel attacks that you might have to worry about, where maybe somehow you exploit some loophole where there's some aspect of the real device that's not captured by the proof. And there are people, including a lab at IQC and at other places, where people try to attack specific implementations of quantum key distribution, not by attacking the proof, of course, but by attacking weaknesses in the realistic system. So these side channels are always a problem. And something which would be nice to do would be if you could really get So maybe I'll just write. You have to in practice you have to worry about side channel attacks. So something that would be nice would be if you could have a quantum key distribution protocol that did not rely on any assumptions about how the device was built. So that didn't rely on what was going on in the device at all, but just had to do with something about the statistics between what was measured in Bob's lab and what was created in Alice's lab. Just look at the statistics of the signals that were sent, and maybe we would assume something like the correctness of quantum mechanics. That seems like a pretty safe assumption, but we wouldn't assume anything in particular about how the devices are built. In fact, the strongest sort of thing like this that you might do is to try to come up with a quantum key distribution system that would be secure even if the device that you used to do QKD was made by the adversary. So you would even allow Eve to create the devices that you're later going to use to try to do quantum key distribution, but on the basis of just some statistical considerations about what were the signals that you would be sending between the two devices, that you could be sure that you were generating secret key, even though an adversary had made your device. So something that would be even better is what's called device-independent QKD. And sort of the idea for why you might think that this would be possible would be because of things like what are called Bell inequality violations, right? So that there are these inequalities called Bell inequalities that have to be satisfied in what are called local realistic theories, but that are violated in quantum mechanics. And what you could try to do would be use the violation of Bell inequalities to convince yourself that what you had was something that was well approximated by an entangled state. And of course, if you had a maximally entangled state, 0, 0 plus 1, 1 over root 2, there's this principle of entanglement, which is what's called monogamy, that says that if Alice and Bob are entangled, that entanglement can't somehow be shared with someone else. It's not possible to have maximal entanglement that's going to really allow you to violate Bell inequalities and at the same time have that entanglement also with a third party, say Eve. And because of this, if you could convince yourself that you were really creating states like this, then by measuring states like this, you could get bits that would be guaranteed to agree with each other, and you could try to use those as key bits. And there's actually a protocol, which is due to Eckert, from a little bit later than the BB84 protocol. I think 92, I'm not absolutely sure about that, 91, something like that. From Eckert in the early 90s, which you know sort of says that, well, if you can distribute entangled states, then you can measure those and you can use that to distribute secret key. And you might think that by sort of showing that you could violate Bell inequalities, you could convince yourself that you could create these entangled states, and that would give you another way of doing QKD, but in a device-independent way, so that if you had the sort of statistics that would come out of these states, then you could be convinced that you had cryptographic security, even though you didn't really know what was going on in the devices. And I mention this because just in the last couple of years, people have actually been able to prove the security of these device-independent QKD protocols. So there's been some results from just like a year or two ago by people like Umesh Bazirani and Thomas Vidic and others, where they've been able to show that that you can give proofs of security of protocols based on device-independent QKD, where potentially the adversary could even be fabricating the devices, and still you could be convinced of security. These protocols are still not what I would call practical, but you know it's an interesting development theoretically, and maybe this idea eventually will even be useful in devices that you could try to build for QKD. Yes.
So what kind of things would you specify for about the device for something like this? Because I mean, you could just do the really dumb thing of like you take Eve's machine to do it, except she's built in something that automatically transmits the result of a measurement to her, right?
Right, right. So so you have to know something about these devices, not being able to send signals to the receiver. So I guess you have to know something about what are the allowed. There are always going to be some assumptions that go into these kinds of things. So you have to know something about the inputs and outputs. That what this device can do is it can, it's going to give you some numbers which are, it's going to give you some string that's going to give you some bits that where you can compare the statistics, on the two sides and use that to get this kind of, show these violations of Bell inequalities, et cetera. But you have to sort of know, I guess, that that's the only output of the device. But you could imagine that you could do this by,
So you want to
putting
not
the thing
about
in a,
the internal workings.
That's right. You don't want to have to know about the internal workings. Maybe you have to put the device in a Faraday cage or something like that. But you're never going to completely remove loopholes. And honestly, like the problem with cryptography and security is that you can sort of try to do mathematics all day long until you're blue in the face and kind of convince yourself that you've proved security. But if Eve goes to Bob's lab with a gun. It doesn't matter what quantum mechanics says, right? The weak link in like realistic implementations of security, generally speaking, will not be things like, whether Bell inequalities were violated, but some more practical concern. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I guess that's it. So thanks a lot. It's been fun, and I hope you learned something.